Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson. Joining me in a bit will be Tim Phillips. He will join us for the review this week, which is a war movie, which I don't think we've done in a while. Maybe not since Dunkirk. Well, we've probably done some war movies since then. Not exactly a popular drama these days. Or genre, I should say. Not exactly a popular genre. You know, feeling a bit besieged as we are, given current conditions. So we will explore a real-life siege this week. One that happened in Afghanistan in 2009, involving, you know, guns and mortar fire and soldiers under pressure. So we can live a little vicariously through them, instead of being focused on our own besiegement. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new Afghan war drama, The Outpost, which you can now watch on Netflix, or you can see it on any VOD platform as well. It is one of those movies that was supposed to come out, actually supposed to have its premiere at South by Southwest earlier this year. South by Southwest was canceled this year. It was like right at the end of March, so right at the beginning of all the lockdown and the COVID and the stuff. And it was released on VOD, and I think even maybe some, actually no, I don't, I'm not going to say it was in limited theatrical release either, because that wasn't until like late August, but it was definitely released on VOD earlier this year, and it's now available on Netflix. So if you do have your Netflix account, you can access it easily enough. So, before we get into The Outpost, though, we're going to cover some movie news from the last week, which includes some release news. There was a rumor, or there is a rumor going around, that the next big Hollywood movie to hit streaming is Godzilla vs. Kong. And Godzilla vs. Kong, which is a continuation of Godzilla, Kong Skull Island, and Godzilla King of Monsters, that Monsters Shared Universe franchise, it's changed release dates a couple of times. It is now currently slated for release in 2021. Rumor Control says, though, that Netflix offered the studio, which is Warner Brothers, $200 million to throw Godzilla vs. Kong up on Netflix instead. I would argue that this is not a similar situation to what happened with Bond, No Time to Die, a couple of weeks ago. It is very different. I mean, Bond is all but guaranteed to make $1 billion. I'm not sure the same can be said about Godzilla vs. Kong. The last two movies were certainly successful. They weren't exactly barn burners, though. And it may be a smart investment to just throw it up on Netflix instead of, waiting to release it in the movie. Because first of all, there's going to be a glut of movies that are coming out in movie theaters once it's kind of safe to start going back. And second of all, we still don't know what kind of success movies are going to have when they go back to the movie theaters. I mean, certainly we've seen mixed results with Tenet. And if there was one movie that was going to have any shot at getting even more close to $1 billion, it was probably going to be Tenet. But alas, I think it hasn't even broken $400 million worldwide. Anyway, two things kind of stand in the way. Number one is HBO Max, because Warner Brothers is releasing the film. HBO Max is under their corporate umbrella. That seems to be the more likely the place. Nobody has said anything either way about this, but I think they're going to wait and see what happens with Wonder Woman 1984 to see what kind of uptick they get when that comes out on HBO Max on Christmas Day. And if that is the smash success they think it's going to be, then chances are they might follow a similar pattern with Godzilla vs. Kong. At the end of the day, it's a weird situation because Legendary, which is the production company behind it, has financed 75% of the film, but they have absolutely no say in whether or not or where and how the movie gets released. That's entirely in the hands of Warner Brothers, and they're not going to want to sell this to Netflix. And take the glory and the profit, and it's just a matter of maybe Legendary would be interested, but they can't because of the Warner Bros. Situation. Anyway, speaking of Wonder Woman 1984, I am sad to report that it's not going to be available here on Crave. Crave has been re-airing a lot of the HBO Max stuff. It's kind of become the Canadian distributor for a lot of HBO Max stuff. So you can watch American Pickle on Crave, which was made for HBO Max. The Flight Attendant, the new TV series starring Kaley Cuoco, has been running on Crave here in Canada. It was made for HBO Max in the States. But not Wonder Woman 1984. This is not a first-time occurrence, though. The Witches came out on HBO Max back in October, and it did not come out here on Crave. And I think this is like a matter of the fact that, you know, movie theaters are closed in Toronto, which is by far the biggest market, and then in Peel region as well, and York region, where there is, you know, conditioned red lockdown measures. Movie theaters are still by and large open in Canada. Looks like we're not going to get Wonder Woman. I mean, on top of it all, I appreciate that Peter and I went to the theater to review Tenet a couple of months ago, but I think conditions have also changed a great deal as well that would make me second guess about going to the theater now. Not that I'm necessarily scared I'm going to get COVID going to the theater, but it just, the conditions are different now. Anyway. Speaking of untimely deaths, there was one on the weekend that will certainly make fans grieve a little. David Prowse, who is the guy who played the physical body of Darth Vader in the original trilogy, he passed away at the age of 85. He was a bodybuilder before he went into acting. He participated in the Commonwealth Games in the 70s. He's also, after Star Wars and before Star Wars, he was also part of the Casino Royale spinoff. He was also in A Clockwork Orange. He was also in several Hammer horror movies. He's the guy who trained Christopher Reeve for Superman. So this guy has left a pretty big mark on movies in general, not just those original trilogy movies. But, I mean, it's another sad... it's another sad situation because we've lost Peter Mayhew in recent years. We've lost Kenny Baker in recent years. Carrie Fisher as well, obviously. And so David Prowse makes it another sort of sad loss for the Star Wars family. And rest in peace, David Prowse, who I think I did see him at a con once. He was at Fan Expo 1 year. I think he did a fan appearance with Jake Lloyd. So you had the body of Darth Vader and the guy. Because at that point, Jake Lloyd was an adult. And so the guy who played young Anakin Skywalker. So that was a good double bill. They were a good act. What else we got? Speaking of Star Wars, this is an interesting story. That the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Association is backing Alan Dean Foster. You don't know who Alan Dean Foster is? He's the guy that wrote the novelizations for the original Star Wars trilogy, and also the first three Alien movies. He was he's a sci-fi author in his own right. But I mean, once upon a time, before you know, movies would come out on home video like 3 months after they were in theaters. You know, when there were huge windows between home video and seeing a movie in the movie, or even when there was no home video at all, when there was a huge wait in time, you see a movie in the movie theater, maybe it comes back for a reprise, but then the next time you would see it would be, you know, on television. It would come on the Sunday night movie on NBC or whatever, Star Wars. So the novelizations, if you were a fan and you wanted to relive the fun and adventure and the glory of the Star Wars movie, your best way to do that was the Star Wars novelization. So a lot of these things are out there, a lot of copies, and they're still in print. But Disney, it seems, has stopped paying royalties to Alan Dean Foster. And it's especially difficult, too. He's in poor health. His wife's in poor health. They're trying to get answers out of Disney. And apparently Disney will not open the book and talk to them about it until he signs an NDA, which is kind of inadvisable that, you know, you sign a do not discuss agreement before you even go into discussions. so Disney's getting a lot of flack for this, the maltreatment of a man who had more than a little small influence on the franchise. Another case of, you know, Disney hegemony and bootstrapping people, Disney becoming the evil empire, ironically. So that's a sort of a small thing to watch, but it's well worth watching just the same. And other Disney news, if you have a Disney Plus account and you go and watch Black Panther now, you will notice that they now have a tribute reel. The title card that comes out at the beginning, it says Marvel Studios. There is now a tribute reel to Chadwick Boseman, who unfortunately passed away a couple of months ago. He, of course, played Black Panther. This is the first time Disney has done something like that since 2019, where the opening of Captain Marvel had a similar montage at the beginning with the Marvel Studios logo for Stan Lee. Captain Marvel was the first movie to come out after Stan Lee passed away. In Black Panther 2 news, it's been reported that it will start shooting in July. Narcos star Tempe Huerta is going to play one of the villains in it. What has not been answered, though, is what they're going to do about the titular Black Panther. Is that going to be filled in by Letitia Wright, who played Black Panther's sister in the first film and in subsequent Avengers movies? Are they going to just straight up recast T'Challa as, with another actor? That has not been resolved, but clearly if they're setting release dates and booking studio space and getting ready to roll for July 2021, they must have all that worked out, or very close to having it worked out. And then finally, in last bit of Marvel news here, Deadpool 3 looks like it's going forward. They hired a pair of writers, Wendy Molyneux and Lizzie Molyneux Loughlin, are going to be writing. They writers on Bob's Burgers, which is not a show I'm terribly familiar with, but I know that it has a lot of fans and it's terribly irreverent and fits in well between The Simpsons and Family Guy, where it airs on Fox. It is interesting to note that the two original writers of the first two Deadpool movies, Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick, are not going to be coming back, and I do wonder how much of this has to do with the blowback of fridging Marina Barkin in the second Deadpool movie. And of course, I think we talked about this at the time that Deadpool 2 came out, that how weird it was that two writers, Reese and Wernick, who are so steeped in comic book mythology and lore, were unfamiliar with the term fridging, which was, of course, the term coined by comic book writer Gail Simone after a Green Lantern comic book had the new Green Lantern's girlfriend stuffed into a fridge by a bad guy as a way to motivate him. It's generally seen as not a very, well, I'll say woke thing to do. I mean, even back in 1994 or 5 when that comic book came out, it was seen as not very cool or interesting or particularly original way to sort of motivate a male character by killing off his girlfriend and or wife or something like that. And I wonder if Ryan Reynolds has felt that those two, very clearly Ryan Reynolds is in creative control on this project now, but I wonder if he felt that Reese and Wernick were maybe a bit out to lunch on what it is he wants to do. There were a lot of creative struggles going into Deadpool 2, from what I understand as well. So this creative friction between Ryan Reynolds, who you literally can't do the movie without, and writers. And of course, in Hollywood, writers are always replaceable. But I mean, this is a really interesting sign. Deadpool 2 is moving forward. There have been a lot of, with Disney, because now that it owns Fox and now that it owns the X-Men subsidiary characters again, could they do the rated R version of Deadpool? That is, we don't know the answer to that yet, but I have a hard time imagining Ryan Reynolds being willing to proceed with a Deadpool movie if he couldn't like do it his way. Having said that, he is in Free Guy coming up, which is a Fox movie under the Disney banner, which is going to be PG-13. Maybe this is the start of a watered down Deadpool. We really don't know. In other casting news, Mads Mikkelsen has officially joined Fantastic Beasts 3 as Grindelwald. He is replacing Johnny Depp. A lot of people are still upset about Johnny Depp being fired from the project. There is a petition with has 1.5 million signatures now that demanding Warner Brothers fire Amber Heard, I guess because two wrongs make a right. I don't know the logic of this. Granted, I also don't know all the details because I'm sort of viciously avoiding Hollywood gossip and have for years. So I don't know the details of the case, but there's clearly a strong constituency of just really horrible people who feel really passionately about Johnny Depp's job prospects for some reason, and I don't know why. I would argue Mads Mikkelsen easily a step up for that role. Mads Mikkelsen is a, I think in recent years, proved himself to be a very complex and intricate and sexy actor too. And you know, a lot of people do find him a very sexy actor, and I think it'll be more interesting to watch him in this role rather than Johnny Depp, who feels like his, I mean, no matter what you feel about his personal life, for what some reason, his shtick feels kind of worn out. Maybe just to wrap up quickly, Dan Trachtenberg, the director of 10 Cloverfield Lane and the first couple of episodes of The Boys on Amazon, he is making a new Predator movie. I don't know at this point what more you can say about Predator, but Dan Trachtenberg is apparently going to say it. And then Stephen Cappell Jr., who directed Creed 2, is going to be the next director of the next Transformers movie, and they're apparently working on two scripts, which is doubly funny because they spent all this time with a writer's room of people developing Transformers scripts and Transformers storylines, and apparently that all was for nothing after the last Transformers movie. What's not funny is support for the Guelph Black Heritage Society. There is a new compilation of electronic dance music out called Guelph Tomorrow by various local artists, and you can find it on Bandcamp, but we're going to play a track to ease us in to this week's review of The Outpost. This is Akitsi and The Eye of It. You can find it on Guelph Tomorrow by various artists in support of Guelph Black Heritage Society. We'll be right back in a minute. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Dialed in.
And how would you do it if you were them?
What?
How would you do it if you were them?
How would I do it? Well, first I'd knock out our mortar pit. Then I'd start hammering our stand two trucks, armored Humvees, especially Alraz 2.
That protects our mortars.
Take out our ammo depot so we can't resupply. And I'd hit our generator.
Effectively kill our comms. And then I'd start sending fighters on the switchbacks. It'd be a race to get inside the wire before air support.
Yeah, but even this can take a few hours. The B1s come all the way from Qatar.
Yeah, that's right, Carter.
Yeah.
I'd get inside our camp, take our ECP, divide us in half.
Damn it, bro. A little pissed in your Cheerios.
Well, sorry, pal, but that's life at Camp Keating.
And that was a clip from The Outpost. It's the new film from Rod Lurie, and it stars Scott Eastwood, Caleb Landry Jones, Jack Kessie, Milo Gibson, Kwame Patterson, Corey Hardrick, and Orlando Bloom. I am now being joined on the line by Tim Phillips. Tim, how are you today?
Doing well. How about yourself, Adam?
I cannot complain. I'm doing pretty good. December is finally here.
Yeah. Fairly mild weather, which is nice.
likely will not last. It's strange that when we recorded last week's episode, Candace and I, it was a full-blown winter storm. And as we're recording today, it is bright and sunny and relatively mild. And I guess that's life in a nutshell these days. Some days are really pleasant and other days are just pea soup.
Yeah, that's how the weather is. And it's nice and sunny now, so... Even though we're all in lockdown or various versions of lockdown, you can at least go out, go through the park, have a nice walk, you know, enjoy it. Enjoy it while you can, right, Adam?
Yes, they have not locked down the parks yet.
There's no police tape blocking out the park.
I think that's a good segue. The dangers in plain sight is a good segue for this week's movie, The Outpost. Which is based on a true story, war story, from 2009, about a group of American soldiers on, I think it's the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan, who came under attack, although they were under a constant state of attack, and we'll get into that. But Tim, this was your choice to review this week, so why don't we start with your initial thoughts on The Outpost?
Yeah, so I chose this. I was looking for a high quality film, really, of any genre. Picking like a war movie during the pandemic might not be the most uplifting choice, but I saw that it got really good reviews and it looked like a really compelling story. So chose this one, and it did deliver. It's quite compelling, based on a true story, as you mentioned, about a battle that took place in Afghanistan between the Taliban and U.S. troops in 2009. And like we were saying about the playgrounds, but there's this ominous nature about it. There's this impending sense of doom in the film, which you can see just from the situation these soldiers find themselves in. They're in an outpost in Afghanistan, but it's at the bottom of a valley. And so there's all these mountain ranges all around them where, you know, any enemy can go up there, spy on them, see them, snipe at, you know, snipers can be up there looking down on them. And it's that sense of danger in the sense that they don't know why they've been assigned this, but they know it's their job. So their duty is to protect the outpost, but you know, they're there wondering, you know, why are we here and having to defend against attacks from an enemy that has so much of an advantage over them. And you see that throughout the film. You just see how they are in a precarious position and how they have to do their job, work as a team to really just defend themselves, just to survive. I think early on in the film, they mentioned, you know, what's the goal of this mission? And it's basically to survive. And so it's not your typical war film where it's like, okay, act of heroism, this is going to help us win the war. This is more like very practical. How can they survive day to day? And I thought there were some really great performances in the film. Scott Eastwood, Clint Eastwood's son, he has quite a presence about him. Reminds you of Clint Eastwood. He just has that leadership presence about him. And I also thought Caleb Landry Jones as Carter really added a lot to the film, which, you know, is conventional in a number of ways. But having that character who's sort of like the weak link early on, you see him as the weak link. He's not really working with the team that well. He's kind of got, you know, attitude problems, but the fact that you can see the humanity in him and how he can work with the others and really show his true colors later in the film. I thought that was a great performance by Caleb Landry Jones. And it's all based on a book by Jake Tapper, who CNN viewers will know. He's on CNN. He has his own shows on there. And it was all based on a true story, which is quite interesting. And I thought, as much as there were a lot of conventional moments to it, I thought it still was, it seemed so true to life and so based on just trying to survive in these conditions that are, you know, that were imposed upon these young men, that I thought it was quite compelling.
Mm-hmm. I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I think I'm not sure I agree about Scott Eastwood. I think he manages to tap into some kind of character in this, which he has not been able to do in a lot of what I've seen him in. He was in the last Fast and the Furious movie as kind of like the underling of the Kurt Russell character. And I mean, you can sort of see he was brought in as the kind of the bland white boy replacement for Paul Walker, except Paul Walker has so much more personality to him than Scott Eastwood did, at least in that movie. And I don't say that lightly, because Paul Walker is like the epitome of like bland white boy. You know, rest in peace, Paul Walker. I think that there are a number of things that are working in Scott Eastwood's favor here. Number one is that, I mean, it's a large cast and largely unknown actors. So, I think that plays to the benefit. One of the things I really didn't like about The Outpost was the constant barrage of title cards to tell you, here's Carter and here's Souza and here's like this officer and here's this this man and here's their names. And I understand that, you know, you mentioned Jake Tapper. Jake Tapper is an award-winning journalist, a very successful journalist, a well-known, well-respected journalist. I think, you know, the first thing they teach you in journalism school is, number one, get the names. Number two, get the correct spelling of the name. And I think that kind of taps into that idea. And of course, Rob Lurie, too, the director, was also a journalist. So it properly identifying who and what and where this is kind of in the DNA. But I also think that it's very largely, not largely distracting, but it is distracting in a sort, because you feel like you're being given a program at the beginning of the movie and that you're going to have to remember all these names. And there are a few characters who are sort of important as the story progresses. They sort of become the focuses of the film. And, you know, the Eastwood character, whose name is Sergeant Ramesha, and the Landry Jones character, Carter, I mean, they're the two who stick out because they were the Medal of Honor winners out of the battle. So, I mean, it's understandable why the movie would follow them specifically. But, I mean, the rest of the movie, though, it feels very much like it's not just about this particular story, which of course it is, because there are so many details to it, but it's also very much a soldier story. So I appreciate, you know, getting the roll call, but the movie kicks off like that, I found it just very, very distracting. I just would have sort of preferred to just, you know, get into the story. I can learn names as we go. I mean, and one of the things that I think The Outpost will remind people of is Black Hawk Down. There are certainly a lot of comparisons between this and Black Hawk Down. I may be misremembering Black Hawk Down, but I don't remember being loaded up with all the names that, you know, Ridley Scott just sort of trusted the audience to, like, let you sort it out through the course of the siege. And I mean, but that, like I said, that I've been talking about it for 5 minutes, but that's like a minor gripe.
Seems pretty major to you, Adam. I was about to say, I thought you were going to go on to another topic there, and you just stayed on the... Yeah, but it is, I know it's a stylistic thing that does hit you right away, right? They start showing names right away. And I actually kind of thought, it was almost a joke in my head, is they went through more captains than Spinal Tap went through drummers, almost. And it's kind of like, they're like, this is the captain's name, this is the next captain's name. And maybe if they stuck just with the captains, because the captains were the commanding officers and the leaders, and it shows how, you know, Captain Keating, played by Orlando Bloom, is the first one we see, and then he's gone. They name the outpost after him. Then you have the next commanding officer, and then the next one, and then during the big battle, they're like between commanding officers. One's just arriving, I believe, while that battle's happening. So that might have been interesting with the title card to indicate, okay, now they're on to the next commanding officer here, next one, and just show, because a big part of this is, you know, maybe a lack of leadership or transitions between leadership that is causing danger to the troops, to the everyday soldier on the ground. That might have been okay. But yeah, I do agree, when they start getting into every name, it can get to be a bit much, right? And some of the names, like, they're showing are in the scope of the film, probably not in the scope of the battle, but in the scope of the film, are kind of minor characters sometimes. They're like, this person, and I don't remember all those names. They're like, this is Griffin, and they show a guy playing a guitar, and it's like, okay, yeah, fine. Yeah, I'm not going to remember that guy, but that's fine. So I think you make a good point there, and that's trying to add some stylistic choices to it, to make it a bit different, you know, than what you've seen in conventional war movies. But yeah, I do agree that it's probably overboard. I would have probably just had the captains, and I might have used their names just to show how they kept having to transition under new leadership all the time.
I even found that kind of, because every time you have a turnover of captain, they basically have like an act break, and they put up the name of the new captain in a title card. And it's just, I understand that too. You're kind of making the point of how this outpost is sort of cycling through captains. But I think it kind of, after Keating, who, you know, it very pointedly dies in sort of doing like following orders for just like this very minimal task. It's not a very, you know, quote unquote heroic death. He's just sort of discharging a typical duty by moving this truck from one point to another. But you know, other than that, I think you lose some of the punch of just like how quickly, like, I don't even remember the circumstances by which the second captain goes. Like, was he killed in action, or did he just like get on a helicopter one day? I just remember the title card coming up. It's like, oh, now there's this new captain. And you're right too, you sort of the captains sort of get progressively, I don't want to say worse, because I mean they were obviously trying to discharge their duties as best they could, but you start off with Keaton, who's a very like cowboy kind of officer, very, you know, tight with his men, and then you get the next captain, whose name I can't remember, who
I think still, he dies on a bridge.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he, you know, he's still kind of connected to the men, but, you know, he's a bit more diplomatic, a bit more bureaucratic, and then you get the captain right before the battle, who is clearly out of his element, and even a couple of the men, you know, make mention that, you know, he's likely to get them killed because he's so rigid, and
it's, never leaves his office, just has bottles of urine he keeps passing for them to burn.
Right.
He doesn't leave, right? So they call Broward the coward. I think the one actually is, I looked it up, he's Mel Gibson's son. Milo Gibson was the, so there's a lot of sons in this thing. He was the second commanding officer, and he was killed on the bridge. And yeah, one criticism I have of the film is it's pretty, it can be obvious when they're going to get attacked, right? So it's like, okay, they're having this, they're talking about the dog, or they're feeding the dog, and you can just tell, okay, they're going to get fired on right after this. It's just that sort of conventional war thing. Okay, there's a light moment. Okay, jump scare coming now with the gunfire. And the same thing on the bridge. You can see they're out in this precarious bridge, patrolling it, this hanging bridge, and you just know. You can just predict what's going to happen. So that was that was a criticism I had. It's still an exciting, entertaining. You're compelled, but there are those moments where, yeah, it's just falling back into that sort of cliche you see often. Okay, everything's back to normal now. Oh, here it comes. You know.
Yeah.
Here comes the gunfire. Right.
Well, I think. Yeah. I think Laurie takes that into account because, I mean, there are also a lot of scenes, and I made note of this, where they're kind of going about their daily business, and then a couple of Taliban fighters show up and start taking shots at the camp, and they're forced to drop everything they're doing to respond. And aside from the first attack, where it shows in detail how, you know, the unit has to respond to take out the attackers, most of those scenes sort of end with a smash cut of just them responding, and then it moves on to the next scene. So you are made to understand that, you know, they end up resolving these fairly quickly. It's a constant sort of state of life at this base that they are just going about their daily lives. One of whom, you know, was sort of coming out of the shower, and I made note of this too, that, you know, there's a scene where one of the soldiers comes out of the shower, they fall under attack, and he's firing back bare naked, which, you know, also does, you know, a fairly good job of just making sure you understand the danger that, you know, even when in a battle, when you drop your towel, you can't drop your gun. So I appreciated a lot. But you're right. There are some, I mean, the war movie is like maybe one of the most trope heavy of the genres too. But I mean, Laurie does it very, very well. I mean, I think I've said this before on the show, like even when something's formulaic, you can do the formula really, really well and still make a good movie. And I think this is a case of that there. But I mean, Rob Lurie also does a couple of interesting things. One of them is that scene you mentioned where the new troops arrive at the outpost, and you just sort of see where this outpost is situated in the mountains. And there's this, I really didn't expect it of Rob Lurie, because it's kind of like, you know, Kubrickian or Lynch-like, where it's just like he does this pan over the ridge line where you feel just completely disoriented. Like, you know, you feel like the mountains are kind of closing in on you. And it gives you a really great sense of what, as the soldiers are explaining the dangers, it's like, well, you kind of feel the danger and just the way the camera is moving around across the ridgeline. There's also a scene later on where they're patrolling in the ridges above the camp. And Scott Eastwood's character explains basically how the insurgents would attack the camp in terms of a big attack that, you know, they've long been expecting. And of course, when the actual attack begins, it is executed in the way he predicted. And then the other thing, and it's kind of comedic in a way, which is why it works so well. But they have a translator at the camp who's constantly telling them that the big attack from the Taliban is coming. And they're like, yeah, you know, you're Chicken Little, Muhammad. It's coming. And then right before the attack begins, he is like literally running through the camp saying that the Taliban were coming. And then you get, and it's. At first, and this is another good thing Laurie does too, is that the way the film is set up, where you have like an hour of patrol and attack and life at the camp and attack, and you kind of get into this rhythm. And then this is where the second part of the film begins, is you have Muhammad the translator running through the camp going, "The Taliban are coming, the Taliban are coming," and everyone's like, "Ha ha ha, whatever, Muhammad." And then you have the guy in the armored vehicle at the gun turret, who starts looking at the ridgeline, and then you start seeing all these Taliban fighters basically coming down the mountain. It's like something out of like the Helm's Deep battle in Lord of the Rings, when you see the orcs come over the hill. I don't mean to make that sound frivolous, because this was a real life thing, but I mean, it's just this kind of, oh crap moment, where it was nicely undercut by the humor of this, this one character who we've set up as kind of like comedic, But and they did revisit it at the end where they find him, I think, in one of the outhouses where he's like, see, I told you the Taliban was coming. It's just, it was really well constructed. I mean, so even though Rob Rory does love his war movie tropes, I think he executes them fairly well here.
Yeah, and that's really a pivotal scene. Very exciting when, they're calling him, Chicken Little here. He keeps coming, keeps saying Taliban's coming. And then he says it that final time, and then they look through the binoculars and they see the swarms of people coming down, the Taliban fighters coming down the mountain. So, yeah, and then it holds on for there, that battle, which is key to the film. Obviously, that's the real life event that all the books are written about. It takes place for that, I think, like the last hour of the film or something, and a really, really intense battle scene. And you start seeing some character development too. I think the Caleb Landry Jones playing Carter, it's really interesting to watch his progression to becoming more of a leader. As previous to that, he kind of didn't want to be there. He was just, definitely had attitude problems, did not respond to commands very well. And then when that happens, he takes more of a leadership role when he sees the death around him and people getting shot, and he's there to help them, and you can see the toll it takes on him. And I think it's a very good acting performance by Caleb Landry Jones, because you can see on his face just the pain of dealing with this death and dealing with his people he wasn't even that close with, which is an interesting point. Is he was sort of the outsider to the group. He didn't fit in very well when they're doing their sort of like frat boy jokes and stuff in the camp. He is always the outsider, but he ends up being really affected by this and really taking on a leadership role. And he was, as you mentioned, one of the ones who gets the Medal of Honor from this. So I thought that was a really, really interesting character to watch. If that character wasn't there, otherwise it would be more of that, just A-type macho sort of war movie, which I think Scott, I sort of disagree with you on that. I think Scott Eastwood does a great job being that sort of, type A male leader, in this film. It might be tough for him to expand his acting in other films, but I think for that type of role, which his father made a career of before he became an acclaimed director, really, you think of like the Westerns he was in the Dirty Harry movies. I think Scott Eastwood was of a similar ilk in this, for sure.
I make no mistake, this is the best I have ever seen Scott Eastwood. However, that's not saying much about the past efforts I have seen of Scott Eastwood. And he does have the machismo down, but interestingly, I was watching Magnum Force the other day, which is the second Dirty Harry movie. There is a charm to Clint Eastwood in those movies where, Dirty Harry is understood to be kind of like a bit of a jerk. But I mean, he's a likable jerk, and he has a lot of friends on the force, and a lot of people like him even if they disagree with his methods and his general, looking back 40 years, let's say, toxicness. There is something very charming about Harry Callahan. I'm not sure I could say the same about anything I've ever seen Scott Eastwood do. But I mean, leaving that aside, I think he's very capable here. I think he is certainly is believable, as a staff sergeant barking out orders, coming up with strategy, leading men into battle. I have absolutely no problems with his work here. I think it is the best he's ever done. But yeah. Be that as it may.
Yeah, which isn't saying a lot, like you said. And then I thought Orlando Bloom's character as Captain Keating was very interesting, and how he's trying to negotiate and be diplomatic with the elders in the village. That was interesting. Although it doesn't end up being a big part of the film, right? And that would send the film in probably a different direction if it was more about trying to understand the underlying conditions. Because really, it's more these soldiers are trapped in this outpost, like we mentioned. You know, we're in a valley where there's mountainous terrain, where people, their enemies have an advantage over them, and their life's in constant danger. So that's more of the thread the film went with. But yeah, it was interesting early on. You could see how Keating was a charismatic figure with the troops, how he had their respect, and how he tried to earn the respect of the elders in the community and be diplomatic. And I thought Orlando Bloom did a really good job in that sense. But then, like we said, then it's on to the next captain after that, to really show more of the life of the soldiers, not really get deeper into the conditions that yeah, caused all this, right?
Well, and seeing the way Keaton worked to, you know, and how he went to the people in the area villages and went to them and went into their meeting rooms and their community spaces, where, you know, leaving his gun, taking off his flak jacket. And I mean, it first of all plays into this the characterization of Keating as kind of like a cowboy, but it also shows his I think sincere effort to try and actually win hearts and minds, to use the parlance. Whereas you see the captain later on, where he's all business, the flak jacket is on, and he's very terse and direct, and that's, you know, it also plays into the kind, not that I'm in any position to judge military strategy, but I mean the whole idea of this outpost in the bottom of a bowl in the middle of the desert is, you know, so silly that on the one hand you are trying to prevent the influx of weapons and material support from Pakistan for the Taliban, but on the other hand you are there also to do outreach and you know, work with the local communities to help build infrastructure and make connections. And I think one of the soldiers makes the point that, you know, they go into these community meetings and have really great discussions with the men in the community, but tomorrow many of those same men could also be some of the ones who are firing at them from the ridgeline.
Yeah.
And it just speaks to, you know, what it is exactly they're fighting to achieve. When, you know, one day you are in the middle of the town square having a meeting with people, and then the next day you're shooting at each other. It just speaks to the, I don't know, pointlessness of this entire endeavor.
Yeah, I was about to say it underscores the helplessness of it. Yeah, the pointlessness. That's a good point. Pardon the pun, but like when they get together, when Captain Keaton gets together with the elders and the other soldiers are like, "Sir, these men shot on us. We can tell by like the residue from their gun or what have you." And he's like, "That's fine, but we have to make peace with them here, and we're going to promise them projects." And it just seems, and at the end of the day, there's sort of a pointlessness to it. And it's kind of interesting because this has been a celebrated battle. Like Jake Tapper wrote the book that this film was based on. And I heard that,
he literally wrote the book. Yeah.
Yeah. actually, Scott Eastwood's character, Romeshaw, he wrote a book as well. So I read that he was trying to get that made into a movie before this one came out. So they actually, accelerated this film to get it done before a movie based on his book would come out. And Scott Eastwood actually didn't have much face to face, or he didn't talk to Romeshaw much about his character. So that's kind of interesting in the fact that this is all celebrated, right? It's celebrated, and they show at the end they won these medal of honor, And the, but then you think about, like, sort of like you're saying, the pointlessness of it, the fact that they won the Medal of Honor for surviving and for, you know, getting, saving many lives of their fellow fellow soldiers. But yeah, what's the point of it all? And I think Scott Eastwood's character early on says, everyone's saying, what are we doing here? And his question's better question is, why? Why are we here? Right. So, and, you know, they showed courage and valor in a battle, but what was that even, what was the point of that really? And like you're saying, the trying to be diplomatic and talking to the elders and the community about, we're going to do projects for you, this and that. And then, you know, the same people are firing on them. And there's also a lack of leadership from and a lack of strategy. It is something that's interesting, that is sort of underscored in the film, but not that much, because it is in many ways a war movie and wants to celebrate the valor of these soldiers. But when you think of, you know, there's leadership in Washington, there's leadership there that put them in this position and then awards them with medals a few years later, right? It's kind of, you could definitely take a much more cynical approach to a film like this.
True. I mean, I was thinking about this too. Like, has there been like a really great movie about like the Afghan war? I mean, because it's been almost 20 years, and you know, by the time you've got to 20 years after the start of the Vietnam War, about 1985-ish, you know, you had The Deer Hunter, you had Apocalypse Now, you had, you know, MASH, you had, which was technically about the Korean War, I understand, but, it, you know, it was very much a Vietnam War movie. But you also had, you know, Platoon. And I've been wondering, like, has there been a really great Afghan war movie? I think The Outpost is probably closest. And I think it comes down to the fact that, as you were saying, a lot of great war movies aren't about great victories. They're about small victories or even just basic survival. I mean, you know, Bridge on the River Kwai ends with them blowing up the bridge they spent the whole damn movie building. It's just, you know, even something like Saving Private Ryan, it's, you know, it's about, you know, sending one guy home, like five people died to send one guy home. That's sort of the nature of the genre, is that it's all about small victories or even just basic survival. And I think because of that, The Outpost sort of fits in of a piece with, you know, probably the best tradition of the war movie.
I would say so. And the thing is, like, when you're mentioning the Vietnam War, as history, as more and more people accepted sort of the futility of that war, then you saw films that I think were more, had more almost artistic credibility about them and could go and could make, and weren't afraid to say, you know, what was wrong with the war. Also show just the, like, you think of Apocalypse Now, just the surreal craziness of the whole thing. And you see that in some other films as well. And, you know, there's more in some of these Vietnam movies, you saw a lot more empathy towards the Vietnamese people as in the years that went on. And you think even like movies, I even think like movie like Good Morning Vietnam with Robin Williams, just as you got into the 80s and 90s, there was sort of, you know, as the war was more in the past, there was more opportunity to really look into what problems there were and what the challenges were. And with Afghanistan, which is still top of mind in a lot of ways, it's sort of I don't think we've gotten to that point yet. So
no.
You know, this film does a great job showing sort of like the futility of that, but also shows, you know, that heroism, and they were able to get through it and work together as you know, brothers to get through these events. But it would be interesting, see what kind of Afghanistan war movies come out 20 years from now, or, you know, when there's more time to sort of just look back, look back on the history of all the events, right?
Always assuming, of course, that the Afghan war isn't still happening 20 years from now. But yeah. we'll have exactly. to leave that there. Tim, if people want to find you on the internet to talk about war or politics or whatever, how can people find you?
Flash in the deadpan on social media. Yeah, feel free to reach out if you have any opinions or anything, but that's where they can reach me. Thanks, Adam.
Okay. And that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it, and if you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website at endcreditsradioshow.com. Download it from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean, or get it through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Speaking of Spotify, you can also find the playlist for all the music you hear on End Credits. Just search for End Credits on CFRU on Spotify and hit play. You can find us on social media, on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back tomorrow at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. Go to GuelphPolitico.ca for news and politics stuff. Or you can read my writing about horror movies at Nightmare on Film Street at NOFSpodcast.com. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back next week at 3 p.m. for more end credits, and we will see you then.